Welcome to the Running in the Center of the Universe podcast. I'm Ashlyn Dave, your host. We've got a great show lined up, so let's get started. And this is Ashlyn Dave from the Center of the Universe, Ashland, Virginia, which is Central Virginia, United States of America, and it is the week of September 16th, 2011. I'd like to thank you for downloading the show, taking the time to check out the podcast. If you're a new listener, thinking about listening to the show, I'm not sure if you want to listen to another one or not. Been doing the podcast now for a couple of years, got a pretty decent loyal following, and I've really enjoyed putting the show out. I'm a regular, ordinary, middle-of-the-pack marathoner, half-marathoner, and some ultra distance runner. I do run some ultra distances, but I'm always middle of the pack, closer to the back of the pack. Pretty much just a regular hack out there trying to cover the distance one way or the other and finish events upright. That is always my goal. This is podcast episode 138 of the Running in the Center of the Universe podcast. And This should be kind of an interesting show. It's going to be a little bit going into the philosophical corner. Kind of the theme that I want to talk about is a little bit about the feeling the thrill of victory in reference to having the possibility of failure and then learning from making mistakes. And learning from making mistakes and failure than from easy successes. And the reason I wanted to do a podcast with kind of this as a central theme, and I'm going to share two race stories to maybe kind of, you know, like 75% illustrate this theme. They're not like 100% illustration of the theme. It's kind of like a 75% illustration. One's a race story from my effort at the Baltimore Marathon in 2007. I think it was 2007. And then, and I'm going to compare that to an effort from the 1979 Maryland Marathon of my father-in-law. And then I'm also going to talk about my good friend Ryan's effort at the Edmonton Marathon back in late third week of August, where he set a new PR for himself and made us all proud on Team Incognito. So, before I go too much farther, I want to say how I got this idea, and it's actually from Star Trek: The Next Generation. I don't know if anybody out there who listens to the podcast is a Star Trek fan, but I've been a Star Trek fan since I was a little boy. These of the original series, which was from the 60s, with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and the rest of them. And, you know, I had the little action figures, and I had a phaser, and I had my little shirt with the Star Trek insignia on it. And I guess I think I was looking back. I actually, my dad is cleaning out the basement of their house. It's not the house I grew up in. They've moved, but they still have a lot of my stuff from when I was a kid. And he gave me some old elementary school yearbooks, and I was looking through them, and it was in my first or second grade picture. I was actually wearing my little Star Trek shirt. So, let's see, that would have been, first grade would have been age six, so that would have been 1975. And so that's when I was into Star Trek, back in the mid-70s. My daughter and I have gotten into The Next Generation. I used to watch The Next Generation Star Trek when I was in college. It came on Sunday nights after, before or after Star Search with Ed McMahon. When I was in college from 87 to 91, we would have our fraternity chapter meeting on Sunday evenings, and then we would do something after that, and then several of us would come back to my room and my roommate's room, and we'd climb up in our lofts and turn the TV to the UHF channel up in Harrisonburg, Virginia at James Madison, and watch Star Trek and Star Search. These were the days before cable in dorm rooms, although I think they were starting to run cable back then when I got out, but you had to pay extra for it or something. So I guess now, it's probably part of your tuition. But anyway, that was when I used to watch the Star Trek The Next Generation. I saw just about every episode, and we have the streaming Netflix, and my daughter and I have discovered that every episode is on that, so we have now been watching them. And she's terribly excited about The Next Generation. Not so excited about the older ones. We're talking about the ones with Patrick Stewart, who's Jean-Luc Picard, and some of the others. Jonathan Frakes, I think, is William Riker. And they're good shows, and we've been watching them, and we're up to season two now. And episode number three, which is what we watched recently, and it's called Elementary Dear Data. Data is the android, so... there's a character on there named Dr. Pulaski, and this particular episode was about Data taking on, they have this thing called the holodeck, if you're familiar with Star Trek, and it's kind of like a fantasy land, and go out on this holodeck and act out their fantasies or whatever. I mean, it's nothing of any perverted nature, it's always regular stuff, but Data wanted to go out and be Sherlock Holmes and, you know, act in some story with Sherlock Holmes. And so that was the Elementary Dear Data thing. But anyway, since he was an android, the doctor had actually kind of challenged him that he wouldn't be able to figure out the mystery or something like that. And she said, during the course of that episode, she said two things that I ended up rewinding and writing them down because I thought it would be a good theme for a podcast. And the quotes are the following, and these were made by Dr. Pulaski in season two, episode number three of Star Trek The Next Generation. To feel the thrill of victory, there has to be the possibility of failure. And then the next one is, we learn more from making mistakes and failure than we do from an easy success. And those two quotes can be easily applied to marathoning or any other type of endurance events. And this, for this purpose of this podcast, I'm going to talk about marathons and how, although... when I participated in the Baltimore Marathon back in 2007, I didn't really know about those quotes, but they certainly hold true today. What I'm going to do first of all is talk about Ryan's Edmonton Marathon report. He broke 4 hours, and this was the first time he did that. And he's one of just a couple people on our Team Incognito running group, which is kind of virtual at this point. That has broken 4 hours. So as you can see, most of us are just regular folks. We've had one Boston qualifier. We've got another person that's trying to do it. That's Crash Kreider. I don't hear from him anymore, so I'm not sure if he listens to the podcast anymore. He's probably given up on me. But anyway, and I haven't heard from Snugs that much either, so I'm not sure if Snuggy Bear still listens to the show. He might have given up on me also. But Ryan had ran. We all trained together for our first marathon back in 2006, and Ryan was signed up to run the Marine Corps Marathon. So he ran his marathon about a month before the rest of us did. He and his wife, fiance at the time, then they got married, and that's Rachel. And he did real well, And he's a big dude. He's probably over 6 feet tall, bordering on a Clydesdale, right around 200 pounds, real healthy looking guy, just not fat, he's in good health. He's just, he's large. He's, just a big muscular guy. And he was training for Chicago the Chicago Marathon in 2007 and got injured. And in the meantime, he'd done numerous halves, other events. And, you might've heard me talk about him on the podcast. He's done, I think, at least one naked race up in Canada somewhere in some obscure nude facility, nudist camp or something. I know I podcasted about that sometime last year. I don't remember what episode it was, but I remember he gave me a full race report and I talked about it. When he started training for the Edmonton Marathon for this year, he had a secret goal of breaking 4 hours. And he had sent me a lengthy race report that he posted it on our group page that we have, that's a private group page for our running group. And it was a very lengthy report. So I pulled out some of the highlights that I thought might help illustrate something that you work hard for, something that, there has to be the possibility of not reaching your goal in order to really feel good about when you did reach it. And he started the race not so good. It was really crowded when he got down there. He couldn't get up to the pace group that he wanted to be. He had a very hard time getting past the 4:45 pace group. And it was already getting hot. And he ran the first mile way too fast trying to catch up, and he ran that in 8:35. Now, 9:09 is the mile pacing for a four-hour marathon, and so clearly he was running that too fast. He got to the halfway mark in 1:57:11, which is only 3 minutes banked for the rest of the race if you want to break 4 hours, and that's not really a lot. It is very difficult to run even splits or negative splits in a marathon unless you're highly trained. I certainly can't do it. I could probably run negative splits possibly in a half marathon if I'd really trained for it, but there's just no way I can do it for a marathon. In fact, I run positive splits. They increase as the miles go on. So he only had 3 minutes banked, which meant that that's all he had to work with if he ran into some trouble. He said the conditions got really hot, and most of the hills still remained on the course. He hadn't even got to the more serious hills yet. When he got to the 20-mile mark, it was just at under a few seconds under 3 hours, and that means that the last 10K has to be in an hour or less to get right at the 4 hour mark. And under normal circumstances for Clydesdale type of runners, 10-minute miles are a gift. And but you're talking about doing it after 3 hours of hard running. I mean, of running 9:09 pace, which is pretty fast for a big guy. I know that sounds easy, but if you've already put down those split times, it's definitely not going to be that easy at all. He had also mentioned that there was some times between miles 14 and 17 where he ran. Those were some of his fastest miles of the whole race. So Ryan was really putting it down there, and ended up finishing in 3:58:59, which is really just 61 seconds away from four hours even. 4:01 or 4 hours and 1 or 2 seconds is not breaking 4 hours. So, the margin there is very, very small. And the reason I use this race story, and Ryan, I know I didn't do you justice because you had some of the other details in there, is because his goal was 4 hours. And he barely made it. And there were some times in there where it was possible where he did maybe thought he did not think he was going to make it, is the way his legs were hurting so bad. But for the four-hour marathon to be such an easy thing to accomplish, then it would have very little worth for people. But for somebody like Ryan, and even me to the extent, is a four-hour marathon would be a serious goal and definitely something that would be valuable. And so, and not an easy success. And so that's why that's Ryan's new PR, and I think I have a feeling that's probably why his race report was so detailed and lengthy, is because when something is that valuable to you and it has that much meaning because you work so hard for it, and it is that thrill of victory, because you feel that thrill of victory because there is the possibility of failure. If you run over 4 hours, there is no thrill of victory if your goal is 4 hours, even though 4 hours and 5 minutes is an excellent marathon finishing time. If that was not your goal, then you're going to feel like you failed in that, and you're not going to have that thrill of victory. And to go out there and have that goal and then to accomplish it and to come so close and know that you're so close all along the way has got to make that that much more spectacular for the individual. So, Ryan, my hat's off to you for breaking 4 hours. I think that is really good. And the reason I wanted to say your race story first is because mine is not as spectacular. I wanted to put the spectacular stuff out there first. That was Ryan's race report. Broke 4 hours for the first time in the marathon. I think he's only run a few marathons. He's done lots and lots of half marathons, which is, I think, is one of his favorite distances. He's done lots of 10Ks, and maybe he'll get back into the marathoning now that he has some more time. Ryan, now that you've broken 4 hours, you got to go for that 3:45, because I know you can get that. I know you can get there. Anyway, well done, and I appreciate you sharing that race report. All right, let me talk a little bit about the 2007 Baltimore Marathon. The Baltimore Marathon is part of a running festival they have up there in Baltimore. They have a half marathon. I think they have a marathon relay. They have the full marathon. Yeah, it's a good course. I ran it in 2007. And it wasn't really something I had thought about for my second marathon. I ran Richmond in 2006, and I ran 4:44, and I was pretty disappointed with my effort. For some reason, I just thought I'd be able to put down a much faster time, but on that particular day, not being experienced, I hit a mental and physical wall that just took me a while to get out of, and I finally crossed the finish line. But I was a little disappointed with my effort, and I just, for whatever reason, I just felt like I should have been, with my ability and my size, I should be able to run the marathon in 4.5 hours or less, and definitely took me longer than that. So, I planned to run a second marathon, and for some reason, the Baltimore race piqued my curiosity, and I'm not really sure why, but it did. And as I was learning more about the Baltimore Marathon, somewhere along the way, I determined that it had replaced the Maryland Marathon from years past. And my wife had told me that her dad had run the Maryland Marathon when she was a little kid. So I thought, well, gosh, I wonder what his finishing time was and what his age was. And I think he was, 33 at the time. But he ran the seventh annual Maryland Marathon in 1979. And so what we did is we looked up his finishing time. Well, guess what? There weren't any finishing times for the Maryland Marathon posted online because there was no internet that was available to people back in 79. I searched and searched and searched, and I found the scanned results in a PDF file on a website somewhere. I can't really remember where. Printed it out, and I determined that he had run the 7th annual Maryland Marathon in 4:30:21, 4 hours, 30 minutes, and 21 seconds. So that became my goal for Baltimore, because as far as I understood it, the Baltimore Marathon replaced the Maryland Marathon. Couldn't run the same race, and so I decided to run, the one that pretty much was it. Now, you might think, well, why were you going to do this? Well, my father-in-law, he wasn't my father-in-law at the time when I married his daughter, because he had passed away in 1989. Oh, God, if my wife listens to this, she'll kill me. I think it was 89 or 91. It might have been 91. Oh, hold on, I got it right here. 1990. He died in February of 1990. I remember that my wife Monica and I had just started dating, really. God, it's a long time ago. And when he died, and the manner in which he died is that he had a massive heart attack on his front porch after coming back from a training run. He was a single marathon runner. The Maryland Marathon was the only marathon he ran, but he was a regular distance runner. That was something that he did regularly, but the Maryland Marathon was the only one that he ran. And he never ran any more after the one back in 79. And when he died in 1990, that's what he died from, was he came back and he had some unforeseen heart condition that caused him to have a heart attack. And there he died on his front porch, presumably after he had done what he loved to do, which was distance running. So for somehow I got it in my head that, in a way to honor him and his legacy, I was going to match his finishing time in the Maryland Marathon. And so this became a very emotional thing for me. My wife was going to be up there running the marathon relay, and we had some other friends that we went up with that were participating, and we all got hotel rooms and made a big weekend out of it. But my sole focus, and it was a secret focus, I didn't really share this with other people, that I was going to run the same finishing time that he did for that same route. So. My good friend Tom agreed to run with me, and he agreed to run with me at a 4:30 pace and help me get that goal. I think I had shared that with him. I'm not really sure. I can't really remember, but we got to the starting line. It was pretty cold that morning. I won't go through the whole race report because I may have talked about it before, and I may have actually shared this story in the podcast over the years. I can't really remember. But the bottom line is that I wasn't able to match his time. So it was a failure in that aspect. And so there was no thrill of victory in that case. I ended up running I ran 4:31:40, which was a minute and 20 seconds off of what I had wanted to do. And, you know, it was that was a very painful race at the end. I there were some times where I just, my brain was just going to stop my legs. And I remember running past the Babe Ruth statue there at Camden Yards, and my groin just totally cinched up on me, and I came to a complete stop. First time I'd come to a complete stop in the whole race, except for, I think, once or twice I used, you know, the port-a-john or whatever, and that, which is probably where I lost time. And so it was disappointing at the end. I finished, got my finishing medal, and but every time I think about that marathon, I think about how I tried to run 4:30:21 or something very, very close to that. If I didn't have my watch exactly set up, I could have been off by a second or two. But you know, clearly I wanted to come as close as possible that I could, and being over a minute off was kind of a failure. So I was very disappointed in that. It was a very emotional thing at the end, though, because I had taken, you know, a lot of time off my previous marathon time, and I was still a newbie. I've run so many since then, but I tried so hard and I really gave it everything I had, and that wasn't good enough for this goal that I had in my mind. And I finished upright, I was healthy, I wasn't hurt, and you would think, you should be happy about all that, but I had this one goal in mind, something I was really trying for, and I didn't get it. It was a failure in my brain, and I think that, and it wasn't an easy success. So I think, you learn a lot from something like that. What you learn is that you have the ability to do it, is that you just have to, when you train, you have to figure out a way to take another 2 minutes off your finishing time. You know, whether you do it a little part of each mile, or you do it, you just decide to pick 1 mile in the race and run that one harder and take those two minutes off that you need. You know, that's what you learn. Each marathon you run, you learn a little bit more. And you can't always pinpoint what you learn, but you do learn more each time. And from this particular one, I learned that I wasn't ready to run a 4:30 marathon yet. So anyway, my hat's off to Roberto, Roberto Pino DiMartino. Almost matched it, and I think I did share this one time in the podcast. So, but anyway, the rest of the story there is that I did go on to run a 4:25, and then up to a 4:30, and then to a 4:21, and then a PR at 4:17:37, which still stands today. And I would like to be able to beat that at some point in time. I'm not sure if I'd be able to or not. So those are two race stories that I share to, like I said, they kind of three quarters of the way illustrate feeling the thrill of victory. To feel the thrill of victory, there has to be the possibility of failure, and then to learn more from making mistakes and failure. We learn more from making mistakes and failure than we do from an easy success. I remember I broke 4:30 at the BNA Trail Marathon in 2008, and I just remember I trained on running 3 days a week. That was the same race where my good friend Tom qualified for the Boston Marathon. I just think everybody had it in them that day. I think I ran, 4:25? Yeah, I ran 4:25 and some change. And so I cleared my goal by 5 minutes. And, that was the thrill of victory for me. Because, again, there was that possibility there of not breaking 4.5 hours. Again, when I ran Charlotte, the Charlotte Marathon, ran 4:21, hilly course. And, at that point in time, and that was the first time I experimented with the run-walk. Every 5 miles, I walked for 2 minutes in that race. That was the first time I had tried that theory. Ran with my own water bottle and just filled it up at the water stop and didn't stop and just drank while I ran and walked. And then, of course, ran 4:17 at the Lower Potomac River Marathon minus music, and same thing there. And that was a 25 and 5. So, with the possibility of failure, these new goals became very thrilling. And I don't know if I'd be able to match 4:17 again, but now that I'm kind of doing some of the ultra distances, and I'm not even going to get into the thrill of finishing 50 miles. I've already talked about that, and I could go on for another 20-30 minutes on that. But none of my marathon finishes have been easy successes whatsoever. And you definitely learn a lot about yourself. And One thing is I've heard along the way, and I'll talk about this in a future show, is that if you travel far enough, you're eventually going to meet yourself, and that's very true in distance running. So that's pretty much the content for this week. I do have several emails in the email bag section of the show, which will probably extend the podcast out another good 20 minutes. So let's open up the email bag section of the show and see who checked in this week. All right, I heard from several regular listeners this time around, and first one was from Dr. Smitty, and he ran the Rock and Roll Half Marathon down at Virginia Beach, which was over Labor Day weekend, and he ran it with his son. They had a great time, and one of the highlights from the race, just from an overall perspective, is that an American came in, set a new national record for 15 and under females. Her name is Alana. And you can find out more about that on her blog at alana-growingupfast.blogspot.com. She was the 11th overall in the race, according to her blog. First American, and she set a new national 15 and under record for females. So that is just outstanding. And Dr. Smitty, I appreciate you cluing me into that. So I looked that up. So you can check out her blog. She's got a lot of information on her blog, and from my personal opinion is that she's probably got too much information on there for being a juvenile, but that's just my own my own opinion. I don't tend to peruse through teenage females' blogs too often, but I did check out that one because she did set a new national record for her age group, and I think that's outstanding. So way to go. And Greg, thanks for sending that in. I also heard from Christina. She had commented on the earthquake episode, which was, I think, episode 137. She grew up in California. She remembers when she was in the fifth grade, that was the big earthquake, and there was a big one then. And then in 1989, she was living outside of San Francisco, not in fifth grade, much older at that point. She remember watching the Cosby Show, and the earth started to roll as opposed to shaking. And that was when, you might remember some of the images in the news media about the freeways collapsing on each other. Bay Bridge collapsed, the freeways collapsed. Then she mentioned another one where she was working in an office building and heard the glass shifting before she felt the earthquake and actually knew it was coming. And then her cats would always do something strange on days that earthquakes were going to happen. So she's got a lot of experience with those, and she said it never occurred to her that most people on the East Coast have never experienced it. So yeah, that's Christina, thanks for sharing that. And yeah, that is why we thought it was kind of weird out here, because it's just not something that we normally experience. However, you know, we're used to hurricane and tropical force winds every year or so, and torrential downpours and localized flooding, but certainly nothing like earthquakes. So anyway, Christina, thanks for checking in, and you can check out all her running exploits at lazybonesrunning.blogspot.com or some variation thereof. She's got a great blog that she keeps updated, and she's always got neat things going on over there. On a negative side note, in reference to Christina, she says she looks like she pulled a calf muscle, so she doesn't look like she's going to be running the Ragnar Relay in Napa. So I'm not sure exactly when that is. I think it's probably about the time this podcast is coming out. So sorry to hear about that, Christina. Really am. I know that. I think you were one of the organizers for that, weren't you? Oh, heard from Sandy out of Michigan. Sandy and I had emailed back and forth prior to her effort at the Hallucination 100, which was going to be her first effort at a 100-miler. That was going to be on September 9th. We had kind of emailed back and forth a little bit about her training, because I was curious about it. And she followed the training plan from the book called Relentless Forward Progress by Brian Powell. And I have that book, and it's got some great training plans in there all the way from 50K on up. She said she used the plan for 100-milers that trained on 50 miles a week, and her highest mileage weeks were 50 to 58 miles, with the longest run being 40. The training plan had told her to do 50 miles that day, but it was so hot and she was starting to get cramps in her calves and only could get 40, which is still pretty spectacular. And then she did 10 miles the next day. So, wow, doing a 10-miler after a 40-miler, that is definitely what you call the double long run weekend. She said she didn't miss any runs in the program. She added a mile or two to subtract, or subtracted a mile or two the other day to make it all even, and she would get all the miles in by the end of the week. Didn't do any speed work training, did a lot of hill training. And then on race day, unfortunately for Sandy, the rain was so torrential leading up to the race that the whole course was just muck. And she was a DNF for the 100, but a finisher for the 50 miler. She did get credit for a 50 mile finish because she ran 50 miles, which I think is outstanding. And I did see a picture, I think on her Facebook page, I can't remember how I found out. Her husband was going to be updating her because they didn't have any race tracking. Her husband was going to be updating her status on her Facebook page, and I checked that, I think, once or twice, and that's where I saw the picture, and it was awful. There's no way you can run in that, you know, and it's better just to cancel it and try another day. There's no point in running through muck. She said it in one of her emails to me that she had actually had the mud had gone up to her calves at one point and was pulling her shoes off. So there's no point in finishing, you know, going on with that. So, yeah, Sandy, looking forward to the fuller race report. I'm sure you'll be sharing that on other podcasters. We'll probably pick that up, especially Dirt Dog. But I would like to read it, and I'd like to at least share it with some of the listeners that don't listen to his show. So I look forward to reading something more about the race, and I know you'll take another stab at it again here soon. Thanks for staying in touch. I also heard from Dirt Dog. He thought it was pretty funny about the guy that I saw wearing the onesie at the Patrick Henry Half Marathon. It cracked him up. He just kind of threw out there they wonder if it's a trend that some ultras are starting in the evening and going overnight. As I had mentioned, the Graveyard 100K, which is going to start at 4 p.m. in the afternoon in March of 2012, and he referenced the Hallucination 100, which was a 100-miler that Sandy was running, also started at 4 p.m., which would obviously go into the next afternoon and evening. And he just said he thought that was interesting. He was wondering if that was a trend that was starting. He's essentially run through the night by yourself, and then you can have crew access during the day. And he said even if the course was not difficult, he would think that running at night first would be a lot harder psychologically in lieu of the other way around. And he said that was just his two cents. Yeah, I agree with you, Mike. I'm not really sure what to make of that. I'm looking for 100K, and that I'd like to try. And I got to say that having a race that's 3 hours away on in flat terrain, even though it's going to be probably in a headwind the whole way, you know, I hate to have to pass that up, especially when I'm the one that asked the race director if he was going to add 100K, because originally it wasn't 100, it was just a 100-miler. But then I learned that it started at 4 p.m., so, you know, that time of year, I guess it would probably be dark by, 6:37. I don't know what time it gets dark in March. I can't remember. And then, yeah, you're running most of it at night. For 100K, I think it'd probably be, 16 hours? Maybe 15 to 16 hours. So you figure 4 p.m. I guess half of it will be in light, half of it will be in the dark, you know, because it's, I don't know. It's something to think about, and I think it was something good that you brought up. It definitely gives me something to think about. So appreciate you checking in. And make sure, if you are a listener of Dirt Dog's podcast over at Dirt Dog's Running Diatribe, which has got an excellent podcast, he's approaching episode 100, and he's kind of surveying his listeners, and he's doing a Stand Up and Be Counted campaign, which is a great idea. So check that out at Dirt Dog's Running Diatribe podcast, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. He's a pretty down-to-earth guy. I also heard from Ryan, and Ryan's pretty much, he has listened to every episode since number one, and he said it keeps him connected to Virginia and the running world down here, and it's helped him get through many training runs. Ryan was the marathon story I shared from the Edmonton Marathon. He used to live in Virginia, but he's a, I think he's a, it's his wife that's originally Canadian, but he was American. But they've moved up there. I don't think he was Canadian, but he does live in Canada now. And, Ryan, hope you keep listening. Thanks for being a loyal listener. You know, there's only a couple people that have been listening since episode number one. And, if you're listening to this episode and you are an original listener, send me an email at ashlanddave@gmail.com just so I can remind everybody that there are people out there that have been listening since episode number one. I know Richard's one of them, Ryan, possibly even Doc. I'm talking about when you, you know, in real time, not where you went back, you know, a year later and listened to every episode coming up. I don't even think you can get back to episode number one now. And if you have any comments on the show, you can always reach me at ashlanddave@gmail.com. That gets you into the inner circle, and certainly I enjoy sharing the emails on the podcast. If you do not wish me to share your email on the podcast, make sure you mention that in the email. Anyway, that's it for the emails, and I do have a interesting announcement that may or may not matter to some people, but I think I'm going to run the Richmond Marathon, and that's November 12th. An opportunity arose where my bib number could be paid for. I won't even have to pay for it, and I think I'm going to probably do it. What I've told myself is that I just need to get up to an 18 miler. I have 2 months to do that. I've already done a couple double digit runs, so I'm well on my way. And I plan to do it in with a walk run walk method that I would probably replicate for the ultra in March once I sign up for that. So it's really an opportunity to not try to run a personal record time, because I wouldn't be trained for that, but to attempt a method to cover the distance that might suit me well for doubling the distance plus some a couple months later. So I'll have more about that in upcoming shows, and I'll talk a little bit more about it. But it's a little exciting now to have a short-term goal, and I think with the I've got a real good base right now. I've been running 20 plus miles every week, so I've you know, my body's up there, and I'm feeling good again. In fact, I ran. I'm producing the show on two different days, and I actually ran 5 miles yesterday after work and just felt, you know, outstanding. I might have had something to do with the handful of M&Ms I had before I went out for my run, as opposed to the 5 miler I did a couple days before that, where about 3/4 through the race, I just kind of, you know, lost all energy and somehow muddled through. And it also happens that the weather has turned a little bit, and that always makes things a lot easier for me. So anyway, that's the show for this week. I appreciate you listening this far, and I'll have another show out in 2 weeks. And a matter of fact, I'll be throwing some information in there about the 34th Ashland Railroad Run, which will be April 21st of 2012. My co-race director, Tamara, and I had a pre-planning meeting the other night, just to kind of talk about some of the things that we wanted to do different to improve. And I'm already starting to get excited about that. So that I'll be dropping some things here and there about that in an upcoming podcast. Okay, well, this is Ashland Dave, and I'm running in the center of the universe, Ashland, Virginia, reminding you to run to the finish and keep on running, and don't forget to hug your kids. Y'all have a good week.